Hi, how's campus days going for you guys? Wow, that flat, huh? Oh my God. Should I play it again? Is that what we need? So my name's Craig. I have been here for, this is my third campus days that I've presented at. This time I wanted to go for the longest title award, one that can break Twitter, all of these sorts of programs, applications have gone and set up. I want to try and destroy them with a title as long as I could possibly find. And it's kind of a weird session, this one. It's not like the probably more traditional Microsoft sessions that you've been to. We start with ridiculous videos, and this one isn't really focused on one particular technology or another. It's kind of almost a slap to say, can we start thinking about this in a whole new way? Okay. I'm a premier field engineer, which is, we are 17-ish people here in Denmark. We each focus on our own technology areas, and we come out to customers. So we're the ones that are constantly out with people who have invested and paid for premier support, so additional over and above support. We do things like health checks. So we will go out and look at your Active Directory, your SQL Server, your Exchange servers, and take all of the things that we've seen from doing troubleshooting and put it into those health checks so that we can go and look at your systems and say, we were at somebody someplace else, somewhere else in the world, and we found a bunch of different problems, and you could be heading in the same direction. We also go and teach the workshops, all of the classes that you want to do that are led by Microsoft people, not in the MCT type exams. We'll go and write questions for them, but we won't do those curriculum. We'll do the ones that are more real world focused, more operational stuff, right? And yeah, we work side by side with the guys that you probably have spoken to over the phone. If you have Premier support, you'll get access to just the most amazing people who can help you remotely, that can escalate all the way up to people who fix problems by looking at source code. And if things start getting a bit too hairy, a little bit too complicated, they'll send out guys like us. Okay, so that's kind of how I am. The big question that I've kind of got for you guys, because like I don't know really anyone here, I've seen a couple of familiar faces, but not so much. One that I want to know from you guys is, what are Windows people doing at a SAN presentation at all? That doesn't make sense, right? You've probably left your storage guy at work, and you guys, I'm guessing, are the Windows IT pro type people, right? The third level administrator types. I can see some beards and things, so that's probably about right. So you've left your SAN guy back downstairs, locked up in the basement where he should be, right? Just provision LUNs and be quiet. He's sitting next to the networking guy, obviously, because those two can't be trusted with anything. They'll be physically isolated from the firewall guy as well, right? Double locks and things like that. He's kind of like that guy from that movie, The Goonies. You remember The Goonies? You have that when you were young? You know, they had that, the bad guy family had this little weird monster that they kept downstairs. That's your firewall guy right there. So they're all locked away, and it's just us Windows people left, and we have to go and talk about storage and SANs and things. And why do we want to do that? Well, it's because before I got involved, there were no SANs, right? There was just disks that were constantly being full, and we had to expand and find new ways and ghost and all kinds of weird stuff to fix these problems. But a lot has changed since then. And specifically, I'm talking about Windows Server 2012. This talk is about 2012 R2, though technically about 80% of this stuff relates to stuff that was available a year ago as well. We've gone and added that 20% delta that turns it into something that's going to hopefully blow you away. Okay? So this is what's kind of changed that's promoted this conversation and even made me think this could be something that IT pros should even start considering. Weirdly enough, it's Azure was the first driver. Azure is a really massive monster. When you start digging in a little bit deeper and finding out what actually Azure is, it turns out it's phenomenal. Right now, there's 1 million physical machines, each with 48 cores and 96 gigs of RAM, able to run VMs all around the world. 1 million. And in 2 years' time, we expect that to be about 5 million machines, right? That's exabytes of memory. And what are we going to do with that? And what made us as a company think that that would be a good idea to go and build that, right? We build these huge containers, shipping containers and stuff, 4,000 VMs running physical machines into it, and then designate one of them to control all of that mess. Why would we think that that's a good idea? It was years ago that we thought of all this stuff. Azure has changed a lot about the way that we think about Windows. It's taken what was the source code for the Windows product group and said, we're going to stuff that into the cloud. We're going to tell all of you developers, you are now cloud developers, and turn Windows into this big cloud operating system, which means really go and think of all the cool stuff that you weren't able to do in a package product and make it, and we'll go and deploy it into our own data centers. And if we like bits of it, we'll package them up and we'll sell them out to you guys, right? So Azure is really Windows Server version plus one. That's the way you want to think of it. And then lots of that stuff comes back. It becomes, for us, very expensive to maintain two different tracks of products, right? The Azure version of Windows and the one that we sell to you guys. So we try and keep them as close as we possibly can, but it really is a version ahead. So a lot of the stuff that you'll see here is just stuff that's been in Azure for a really long time, okay? And if you were in, if you got told the next day, you know, you are going to be in the Azure product group, you have to start thinking in a whole different way. If we're going to have a million physical servers running VMs, where are they going to get their storage? We can't. It's not realistic for us to go and fiber channel patch all of those servers up. Right? It's just never going to happen. So we have to come up with a whole new way of storing our VMs, and that's really the core of all of this. And that storage infrastructure as a service is the acronym up there. But the storage must get cheaper without us ever losing performance. That's what we're going for with this, right? We've got to find a way of delivering even more petabytes of data to this massive volume of information we're expecting. I don't know if you guys have heard of this expression or it's been brought up recently while you've been here today even. Something that came up in about March. A Microsoft Research, developer, had this expression, cattle, not pets. We don't want our servers to be like our pets are. Give them nice names, and when they get sick, we nurse them back to health and try and look after them as best we can. We want them to be more like cattle, where we stick a number on them. When they get sick, we go and shoot them. We don't have a little funeral with the kids. We just let the thing die. That's what we want you guys to be thinking about with servers. That container with 4,000 physical machines, that'll run at 37 degrees, right? And servers will die in that all the time, and that's fine, because the cost of replacing a server versus the cost of running that box at 12 degrees, it's much cheaper to run it hot and replace boxes than it is to keep it cold all the time, right? So we're really trying to run all of our machines as cattle, and we'd like for you guys to try and think that way too. All right, having DC01 is really nice on your network, but no users know about that. It's just for you. Okay, you can just as well have a ridiculously named server and then don't troubleshoot it ever. Cost too much. Kill it. Get another one. Fiber channels too slow? What? If there really are storage guys here, one of them would have stood up like this, like, yeah, you want to start something? Yes, it is getting too slow. 8 gigabits a second sounds fantastic, but we'll see as we go that that's almost the worst we can do. And in the product, Windows Server, that you can go and get, you can run a 64-node cluster, right? Not this big, massive 4,000 node. Although, obviously, when I say we do things a different way in Azure and it comes back, you've got to expect that that's the way we're going. I have no idea, right? If you see the org chart of Microsoft, I'm off it. You know, I'm way down the... I have no idea what's going to happen. But they're running 4,000 node clusters there, but they're not real clusters in the way that we're talking about them. But you can build a cluster that's 64 nodes and run 8,000 VMs on it. If you're going to do that, do you really want to invest in all that fiber channel to patch it all up? Yeah, so that's where we're going. So I've given myself a nice big blank sheet of paper here, and what I've got is a digitizer. It's not a fancy Surface. My boss is in here somewhere. If you bump into her, tell her Craig would like a new Surface 2 to draw on. Instead, I'm going to use this little thingy here. So I'm going to show you what, for the guys who are not storage people, who didn't get angry about the whole fiber channel thing just a second ago, I'm going to show you what a SAN effectively is, right? Break it down into its normal pieces, and then we'll have just have a little chat about that. And then we'll turn the page and sort of go on from there. Okay. Let's see, where is my mouse? Okay, what color should we make our sand? How about a blue sand? Nope, that's the wrong B. Okay, red sand it is then. Where are we? Control 2, there we go. Okay, so a sand is effectively a couple of big shelves of disks, okay? Wow, that's the auto zoom gone wrong. How do we get out of that? Is that this way? No. There we go. That was it. Ooh, temperamental. Okay. A couple of... Oh, dear. No. Let's try that one again. My boss really needs to get that email from you guys. Right? Non-capacitive touch. So there's our shelves of disks. Right? Lots and lots and lots and lots of well-behaving disks that will light up and die every now and again. And on top of this... My gosh, draw lines. There we go. On top of this, we have a couple of computers, really. We call them controllers, but they are just a computer that has an operating system running on it. Typically, these guys will also have gobs and gobs of memory off to the side. You might even see configurations with 2 terabytes. If the SAN sales guy was really feeling optimistic, you might see something like this. And these guys connect up to the storage, what would you call them, slices, using SAS or SATA or sometimes fiber channel themselves in between there, you might have fiber channel disks. And then it's up to these guys to be really well organized and have good fast connections between each other to say what they're going to do to the disks and when and who controls what bits of the disk. Okay, these guys will be running a very, very expensive operating system on top of them. Really expensive, one that you can almost not put a price tag on it, but the sales guy managed to eventually, right? And it's called Linux, really expensive operating system, okay? So these guys will now patch themselves up to some fiber channel switch or a pair of fiber channel switches, and then your physical machines will then patch themselves over into here. Now, there's a whole lot of cool features that come in this big SAN box here. Wow, it's gone and done it again. Can we go back? No, you cheeky bastard. There we go. Okay, it's going to do that weird thing again. Ah, you bugger. Okay, so what's in here? What's in that big box that represents the SAN that's now killed itself? We have those 2 controllers, the 2 top servers. They could maybe be 4 different servers. Yeah, it's good. Take a photo of that one, you little bugger. Let me get you another picture up here. I can fix that. I have a backup plan, I tell you. Can't open the app. It's too low. Let's go and edit it then. All right. And zoom out a bit. There we go. Ha ha. So what do we got here? We've got 2 controllers, maybe even 4 as we have up in that picture. They'll have some kind of high availability system, so if one of them needs to be patched or goes down or something like that, then the other ones will take over after the fact, right? So they'll have this swapping and changing business. They'll have possibly the ability to share that cache, right? That cache, that 2 terabytes of RAM, that's there so that when a server requests data, the SAN controller will go get the data blocks, keep a copy of it in RAM, send the rest out to the network card or the fiber channel adapter, sorry. And one of them will do that, and then another one will keep different blocks, but it would be really efficient if they could actually share blocks across that. So they'll do that kind of thing too. They will create false servers, virtual servers if you like, little nodes that they can go and create inside Active Directory that represent a computer account that is a server, and they can go and create multiples of them, and then they can go and share out data, right? You can maybe go and manage those like they are Windows servers and connect to them with the event viewer sometimes, and maybe the share manager you can go and connect to them. So they're kind of there and kind of not. So we can go and create some of those. We can offer iSCSI. We can offer NFS for Unix file systems, SIFS, which is SMB equivalent, if you like, and then full LUNs that are offered through fiber channel, and you need to go and mask those LUNs according to worldwide names, all these sorts of things. You'll get around about, well, I've seen a SAN that could do 200,000 IOs per second, which is an enormous amount of IOs, right? 200,000. An IO would be, go read this block, go write that block. and the size sort of depends on the application. SQL and Exchange will base themselves around 8K, and a file server will try, if it's got big enough files, go for 64K as a write size. So you get huge amounts of IOPS, 200,000. You can also get ones that are extremely expensive but don't have so many IOPS. I was at a customer that had their absolute tier one mission critical application, the one that controlled everything that was their business, all centralized on one platform, was getting about 15,000 IOs per second, which for them was actually okay, right? But they'd invested around 10 million kroner in this blob, the thing that's up on the screen there. They'd invested 10 million kroner on something that got them not a whole lot of IOs. To think, what is really an IO? A spinning disk, a platter that spins at, say, 10,000 RPM will get you 170 IOs per second. 15,000 will burn out faster, but you'll be able to get to maybe 200 IOs per second. An SSD that you bought 3 years ago will get you about 2,000, and one that you get now will get about 3,000 IOs per second. And if we just have lots and lots and lots and lots of disks and we spread our data across them, then we can effectively get more IOs per second. That's how we can see that. Well, we can't see it up there. 200,000-ish IOs per second is a good number. What else do you need when you've got this big box here? You need to have that guy in the basement, right? That storage guy. So you have to go and employ someone to look after it who knows all about that system. You also have a non-upgradable system now, really. When could you expect that you would fill in a change request to your boss, put it in, and it would say something like, we're going to upgrade the SAN firmware, that caching service, we're going to upgrade the firmware on our fiber channel adapters, upgrade the software that runs our fiber channel switches and all the drivers and all of our servers, and then everything will be fine on Monday. Right? You can't just do that, but that's effectively what you have to do. Everything in this whole SAN environment, kind of end-to-end from the driver in Windows all the way down to the disk firmware, needs to match at some level and be approved by the vendor. And the number of times we've gone to these big severity A problems where everything is dead, and it's been because we've done an upgrade in the SAN and something's gone wrong. We see this all the time now, and it's becoming more and more and more common. So they become non-upgradables. That's what I mean. I mean, you can upgrade all the bits, but effectively, you're not allowed to, so you can't, and you're stuck with stuff that's broken. They knew it's broken. I mean, they put it in broken, and they've got hot fixes, but you didn't install them because it was too much difficulty when you put it in, right? You sat with it for 4 years, and you've still got problems with it, and what are you going to do? You can't really go and upgrade it. But it will give you SAN replication, which everyone seems to love, right? So I build one of these 10 million kroner boxes, and then I build another one someplace else, and it can ship the blocks across either synchronously or asynchronously, which is pretty cool, right? The asynchronous part means that we don't have to wait for a response from the other SAN. If it's written in one place, we trust it, and we get good performance at one location. Or synchronous means that we really do have to get a response back from the other place. We can take snapshots of the whole SAN or individual LUNs, and we can back them up. So you take that data, effectively place it offline. All you're really doing is creating a delta on the rest of the disks, and you go and make your writes there. And the part that's read-only, you can still read from, and you're backing up that part there. And when it's done doing the backup, you can go and either merge that data or just make stale all the other bits of data that have been now overwritten by the new stuff. But it's not really a VSS backup, is it? It's the operating system that's controlling that data has no idea that any of this has happened, right? So hopefully it's crash-consistent data, but if it's something like Active Directory, it's not consistent at all. AD doesn't know it's been backed up, so you can't restore it, right? You can't use that snapshot ever again for something like a replicated system. DFS would probably suffer the same consequence too. We can provision things thinly, which is fantastic, right? Take a LUN and say, this LUN is 2 terabytes, away you go. I don't need 2 terabytes of disk to back that up, but I've offered it out, so thin provisioning. Tiered storage. Tiered storage is the ability to say, look, we've got really cheap, slow data on these spinning disks, and we've got a shelf of SSDs, and we will accept writes as they come down into the box, into this storage tier, this SSD tier. They will happen fast. And then when the server is, when the SAN, so we call it a server, when the server SAN starts slowing down a bit, we can send those blocks down to the spinning disks. We can deduplicate data. So if we see two blocks anywhere in this array and we say they're actually the same or similar, we can delete one of them and put a pointer to the other one and say, and that pointer needs this little delta to make it what it was once before. What else have we got? Copy offload. If I wanted to copy a really big file from one place of the SAN to another, like a virtual machine that's running on there, I can do the copy offloaded. So I say to the SAN, do the copy, and you tell me when it's done. And the SAN will move the blocks and say, and now you've completed the copy. And then he gets a completion notification. He doesn't have to spend CPU cycles moving blocks of data from one place to another. And if you're lucky, you might even get a SAN that has a really terrible management interface that can do absolutely appalling performance graphs that have no history behind them and might not include the performance counters that you want. It'll be Java-based, and it'll work through a web browser, but it needs this old version of Java that you don't have anymore and isn't supported and is all unpatched. That's kind of the management story behind just about every SAN that I've had to deal with. The only counter that's really relevant to me is how long do disk accesses take, reads and writes. Okay, anything over 15 milliseconds and there should be a problem. About half of the SANs that I have to go and deal with, they don't have that counter at all. Okay, so that was a SAN, right? That's really what a SAN is. It's got this enormous price tag and a whole list of features. And could you imagine what the Azure product group did when they sat down and wrote down all these features? They kind of said, well, we want to do the exact same things that this setup is doing, but we want to take at least one of those zeros off the price tag, right? Just do it by a factor of a tenth, do the exact same thing. And they've gone there and done that, but they've done it way better than that, right? That 200,000 IOs, you're going to see that is like, that's tiny. So here we go. Before we do the whole Windows version of a SAN, we need some sort of key components that we're going to rely on, all right? Because we just have the software, we just have Windows. As Microsoft, we're not going to go and build Surface the SAN for you. So we have to go and rely on hardware vendors still. We have this thing called JBODs that we're going to rely on an awful lot. I was hoping for a few sniggers there at the little dick joke, but nobody. You're all quite high level. That's really good, because we have some jazz dub fusion coming along at the end for the highbrow individuals here that don't think that dick jokes are very funny. Fine. So here's a JBOD. Here's a set of JBODs, ones that you can buy today, ones that are even on the hardware compatibility list for Windows Server. Okay, that's what they look like, big shelves. You can either get them with the disks on the outside so that you just plug them into the front, or these racks that you pull out, and then they all sort of slot in there. So that one up the top left is that left? Hey, it worked. No, it wasn't. That worked. Yes, that big guy up the corner there, that's got 60 disks inside of it. On the back side, they look like that, where they've just got redundant power supplies and then SAS connectors, so four of them that are redundant as well. Okay, so you can see from this configuration, we can have possibly eight, but much more likely four servers plugged into one of these things. Each of those four servers will have two cables going into it in case either one of these modules die. And on these ones, they've got a network connection, and that's just for SNMP and management monitoring. This box that you see here doesn't do anything. It's got no brains at all. There's no RAID, there's no mirroring, there's nothing interesting happening here. Anyone who plugs into that SAS connection just sees a bunch of disks in the disk manager. They will see all 60, if you had that 60 configuration there, they'll see all 60 of those disks. If I plug in another server, guess what? He'll see 60 as well, right? All four servers will see 60 in there. And all the configuration that we're going to start talking about is limited to four servers, because those guys are limited to four servers. As they get bigger, we'll recommend bigger, okay? But this one that you see behind me is on the hardware compatibility list. You probably noticed the brand name on there. You're scratching your head going, yeah, never heard of that one. Well, here's all of the manufacturers that are on that list, and there's probably one maybe that you've heard of. Well, one definitely you've heard of. Maybe two maybe you've heard of. And that's a good thing. Why is that a good thing? Because these guys are innovating something. They're doing it really, really cheaply that no one's done before, right? These JBODs, they're super cheap. There is no HP on this list. There's no EMC. It's just these guys. They cost a third of what one of those brand names cost. So you can do what I'm about to say extremely cheaply, and you can put a SAN in a branch office without even thinking about it. You can do it without having to drag your storage monkey out of the basement to do any of the stuff that we're talking about. Everything that we're talking about here, you can go back to your office and just start putting together, right? And when you really want it to start performing, you go to say to your boss, I need a special kind of a network card that Craig talked about. You can go and stick it in and then watch your performance massively increase. So here's a Windows SAN. What we've got is I've put it in with four servers, okay? This is a Windows cluster. So these guys are all talking together with normal clustering services running. Each of them is connected to one of these, well, all of these JBODs, okay? And I've got three JBODs listed there, which means that I need at least six SAS ports on my machines that go out from this, from the back of these servers here. So from this guy here, he'll need to have one cable that goes there, another one that goes there, and another one that goes there, and then repeat it to the other side. All right, so I need at least six SAS ports. Now I can go and get myself a little SAS PCI card, stick it into my server, and it'll have two or four slots coming out of it. I'll probably want to go for two, because what'll happen is SAS runs at about 6 gigabits a second per cable, but it's got four lanes inside that cable. So I can have 24 gigabits a second going through one cable. What was Fibre Channel? 8? SAS is massively faster already, right? Just from one cable. And if I go and have three cables, I can contact each of these JBODs. And if I pair them up, I can do multipath I/O down all of them. So I can get 48 gigabits a second to each of these shelves without really having to do anything. So I need three cards in my server. Okay, and the reason that I'm sticking to that three that we'll get to, it's quite an important number there. I haven't put in more shelves. You can, but I haven't in this drawing because we're about to hit another limit a little bit later on. So each of these servers has these cables built into it, and over on the other side over here somewhere, we've got 64 nodes. I haven't drawn them in there because it would look a bit dumb and boring, but I've got 64 nodes. These are machines that are going to connect up to this cluster somehow. All right. So this cluster is perfectly normal Windows server. In a perfectly normal cluster with redundant network connections, I'll offer out file services from this one, and I won't offer out a normal file server. When I go and set up my cluster, I'll call it a scale-out file server, which will give me a whole raft of new features that come with SMB version 3, which is going to tie all of this stuff together. All of these JBODs that we've got here, we're going to take all these disks. We had 60 disks in each of these trays, wasn't it? 60 in each one. So we've got 180 disks. We can pull all of those disks together. All right. So that's a storage pool. And from that pool of 180 disks, we can create spaces inside those. And when you go back to your storage guy, you'll call that a LUN. Okay. So we can create pools and spaces. And a pool is just a massive array of disks, and we can swap them around exactly any way that we want. We could call some of the disks in a mirror, some of them in a RAID 5, some of them in a mirror with a third copy as well, or we can just go dumb striping with no redundancy. If I lose something, I lose it all. When these arrays all talk up to these servers, they announce which array number they are. So they become aware of each other, and that's another function of that little network cable in the back there, was to let each other know who's who. So I can say I am array one, array two, and array three. Windows knows about these array numbers, and it can say, well, I'm going to create a stripe with three columns in it, right? So a RAID 5 with 2 plus 1, and I'll go and spread all of that across all three so that I can lose an entire shelf of disks, and I'll keep running. And you can plug in another one, it will nominate itself to be number two, and all of that data will rebuild itself. Where else do we want to go with this? Let's see. Okay, so we'll do a little bit more about pools and spaces as we go. Okay, let's get on to the networking stuff. How do these 64 guys attach to this set of nodes here? All of these are going to be running VMs, 8,000-something VMs, or they could be running SQL. And their data is going to be held on this file server. And this file server we called a scale-out file server. And his name on the network is backslash backslash FS, Scale Out File Server. You can call it whatever you want. I'm going to call it that. I'll do a little demo with that as we go. So the configuration of these VMs, or the configuration of these databases and log files, their path is not D:\F:\. It is \\SOFS\ and then maybe VMs. That share will then go and point to some pool of these disks. Maybe I've gone and put in 20 disks into that pool. I'll be talking to these. I don't know which ones they are. I could care less which disks they are. But that's where my VMs are stored, right? And the way that I get access to them is just through normal NTFS permissions. I don't have to go through this worldwide name stuff that I had to before, right? You get this 14-character long piece of garbage that identified your fiber channel adapter. Don't have to do that. I use the computer account of the cluster because that's who needs to access the disks. This guy here, he's got an account in AD. I just create a Windows group. It's got access to it. I can do that. Don't need a storage monkey, right? Nice and easy. I need to set up a share, obviously, as well, right? But the same principle applies. Share permissions, nice and easy. Share permissions, now we can go and script through PowerShell. So create the share and permission it as well. So these VMs will go and connect up to these disks and then start booting off them. We've just gone and built ourselves a SAN. But we haven't added anything that's quite clever about this yet, right? We could do this 100 years ago. That's nothing's too clever about this. The bit that becomes clever is this guy here, this scale-out file server, he is load balancing automatically. So I could have connections coming in from some VMs going into this particular node here. Other VMs will go in here, other VMs will go in here, other VMs through there. So I can load balance across all of them. When I'm coming in through my networking, right, to access this stuff through the SMB share, I can do it through a 1 gig NIC. I could maybe do it through a 10 gig NIC. If I'm doing through a 10 gig NIC and I'm talking SMB, SMB has some limits built into it, right? And it's got some locks going on. So if I wanted to say through SMB, say, open up a file, what I really do is I say, my name is this. I'd like to connect to this share. I'd like to connect to that share with write access. I'd like to open up this file. I'd like to open up this file with write access. And each of these is a transaction. And in 2008 R2, we bundled up lots of those transactions and said, just say, open the damn file. And it will imply a whole bunch of other things. And if one of them fails, then the whole thing rolls back and the whole thing fails and access denied will happen or whatever it needs to be, right? But now I can be really efficient in the way that I send off commands. And when we were doing that, we thought, that's a really good idea. We can take that protocol that we own and innovate a whole lot more and add more stuff to it. So that 10 gig connection will often be waiting for one of these bubble commands to come back and fail, stopping other bits of data going and talk to that. If I've got 8,000 machines, some of them will be talking, quite a lot will be talking to this particular node here. But if one of them happens to lock for just a microsecond, it blocks all the other VMs from running there as well. That's no good. So we have this idea of multi-channel inside SMB. So I can have, inside a 10 gig connection, I'll have four separate lanes of traffic going through this one connection. So from this physical host here, let me give some, oops, why is that not doing it? From this one connection here, on his NIC, whoops, this is really bad. On this NIC here, I can get a 10 gig connection out with four lanes of traffic all the way over to each and every one of these connections over here. Four lanes, right? So none of them will ever be blocked. So now I can really get 10 gigs of traffic out of it. If I've got one path to this and it's flooded, and all of my CPUs that manage that one NIC become flooded, I can even go and add another NIC along here, have two NICs at 10 gigs. Each of those will have four lanes of traffic. If any one of those four, now eight, becomes blocked, I've still got seven more. If I lose one of these entire lanes, all of it, that whole connection dies, I can use the other four. And the way that I'm doing that is by having separate IP addresses on each of these, not on the same subnet, right? What will happen is when I turn on this VM on that particular host, it will start talking SMB with one channel through one of the NICs and say, in that conversation, we'll say, I just need to open up this data, blah, blah, start reading the file. By the way, I happen to be running SMB version 3, which implies I can do multi-channeling. What do you do? Yeah, I do SMB version 3 as well. Okay. Well, I tell you what, I've got these IP addresses. What IP addresses do you have? And they'll interchange that information. That's really interesting. Can I connect to you through all of those IP addresses? Yes, you can. Okay. Can I really get 10 gigs between the two ends? All the while the VM's booting up, we're having this conversation. Can I really get to you through all of these IP addresses? And if I can, and if I can get 10 gigs all the way through, right? Because maybe it might be switched or routed down to 1 gig and on up again. If I really can get 10 gigs all the way through, I'll fire up 8 channels. I can just keep plugging in NICs. So now I can get, what was that? We've gone and added 2 NICs, that's 20 gigabits a second. Oh, just what's a small B, sorry there guys. 20 gigabits a second on that, from that one server, full duplex. What was fiber channel? 8. So already we've beaten fiber channel by a factor of more than 3 using super commodity hardware, right? Just normal 10 gig Ethernet that they already have in there. And we can keep scaling that out, right? If we've got 8 NICs, it will use all of them. And we'll have other problems elsewhere, right? Like our CPUs will be flooded. Our PCI buses will be flooded. RAM will be flooded. All kinds of things will start bottlenecking before we fill our network connections. But we can do even more than that. The industry has a new standard that's called RDMA, Remote Direct Memory Accessing. The ability for me as a server to modify your memory, what's in your memory. Because really, when I'm booting a VM here, off on this side here, what I'm trying to do is take blocks of data that are changing on me and make you change them at the other side. And the way that I do that is I send it down through TCP, and there might be some packet inspection software that gets in the way there too. I've got to bundle it all up into 1.5K chunks, or maybe if I've got them put on jumbo frames, I might get a little bit bigger. Send it out through some network, it has to get switched and blah, blah. He has to go and translate it up through his networking stack and then down through a storage stack to touch memory. What if I could just touch your memory? If we have 2 cards in us, special kind of cards in us, that are connected directly to each other with a fixed cable or through some switch that also understands this conversation, I could say, look, I'm about to boot up a VM. I'm going to need 4 gigs of your RAM. Set it up for me because here comes the data. And I go and just send through an enormous amount of data. And the way that you see it, I haven't got a demo of it because I just have the one laptop. I can't bring whole SANs. But this is kind of what you'll see if you were to watch a little graph of it. It's an absolutely amazing thing. So I've got the number of bytes per second going along here. I've got a little time axis going along here. So my bytes per second will be sort of hovering quite low down here. And then all of a sudden, TCP IP will stop. And then my bytes per second will freaking take off. Absolutely massively maximize out. The number of bytes that I can do goes crazy. When my RDMA NIC figures out that I don't just have access to TCP IP, I've also got access to that guy's RAM, he says, the hell with TCP. I'm just going to talk to his RAM and inject data straight into it. I can get through an InfiniBand NIC, right? An RDMA NIC that's a brand name of InfiniBand. It's a license model, so anyone can make them. I can get 56 gigabits a second. 56 gigabits a second per NIC. And again, I can scale those out. So if I had 2, 3 of them, I'll use all of them to send all that data across. All right? 56 gigabits a second. Now think about that. If I have, let's see, I've got a slide on that one. Let me see if I can jump there. Discard. That's why it's PowerPoint. This one here. I have these guys, let's do my control two. These ones here. Where are we? This one here is your most common NIC that you're going to, most common PCI slot that you're going to see in your servers. You'll probably have 2, 3, 4 of these. You'll probably have one of these. Oops. One of those. And you might even have one of those if you're lucky/unlucky. All right? But this is kind of your bread and butter port in your server right now. And my InfiniBand, my 50, that should be 56, sorry, typo, can get me about 5.6 gigabytes a second if you turn 56 into to bytes. 5.6 gigabytes a second. So I'll probably have to connect it up to one of these ones. If I used one of these guys here, it would be a bit of a waste, right? Because I can't ever really max that out. But this NIC here, if I have three of them, I exceed the speed of my RAM. So now my storage stack is no longer slowed down by the back end, like the SAS connections. We can get hundreds of gigabits a second from just having multiple cables spreading all of our I/O across multiple disks. It's not limited by our networking, because we just saw that we can go and get up to 18, 19 gigabits a second from networking. Now what's happening is our bottleneck on our server is our RAM. Right? We can max all of our CPUs out, we can max the memory out, we can max the network, the disk out, and all of the access down into the storage. We can completely hose this one machine. And not just one of them, we can max out four of them as well. And I mean, all of this is 2012. 2012 R2 gets really cool when we say we don't just max out all four of those, we can go and build a bigger cluster where we have multiple blobs of these JBODs, and incoming connections will possibly go to any of these 64 nodes, but it will go to the right node that owns all of these disks. Right? So you're talking to the slash VMs share. You now have to go and talk to this bundle of four different machines that have these sets of JBODs behind them. So we can just keep scaling out and scaling out. And it costs you almost nothing to do it. Meanwhile, we've got, there's our 6 gig SAS connections in there. And there's your fiber channel that you're used to. Look at that. Fiber channel is too slow. The latency behind fiber channel is really good, though. That's what we like about it. Right? We're talking microseconds, not milliseconds, to do anything. But if we have enough SAS connections, we can scale way beyond what a fiber channel ever could. Where was that one here? So here's a little example of one working. So I've got a file server client, and it's running SQLIO, a tool that mimics SQL, which will be 8K reads and writes, random. That's the big thing about SQL. And I go and put in three of these RDMA NICs. They talk to a file server, also with three RDMA NICs. Now remember, they're going to have, they'll look like TCP/IP NICs in your machine. You give them IP addresses. It's just that they'll stop using TCP after a while. So we need each of these three to be on three different subnets. And then a bunch of SAS connections talking down to a bunch of JBODs, all with SSDs in them in this case, because this case is going to give us some performance numbers on the other side. Here's one of them here. 8K random reads, pure SQL, pure exchange kind of stuff on a mirrored space, so disks that are identical to each other. Right? It's not the whole disk that's identical. It's that we've got a block of data somewhere in the JBOD and then another block that's the same. It's not like we're dependent on these two disks and we've just gone and put the mirrored data across them. We've spread the mirror everywhere. I can get 600,000 IOPS per second from something that you can go and build tomorrow. Right? There's no really specialized hardware in here. An RDMA NIC, you can go to EDB Police and get them for about 1,200 corner. Right? That's not scary stuff. RDMA NICs, there's two different types, right? Really, there's the InfiniBand type, and then there's the iWarp. InfiniBand is the short cables connected to a switch, non-routable, right? Because I'm really talking from my memory to yours. We can do RDMA, memory to memory, but we can do it from a routed point of view. So we can go and take that RDMA traffic and bundle it inside 10 gig Ethernet and then make it routable, but we don't get the same performance. So now we're still limited to 10 gigs. So I'm not really going to push you towards looking too much into iWarp. You might as well just go for InfiniBand. Oh, sorry, you might as well go for 10 gig Ethernet, right? So InfiniBand is where you're going to get the huge IOs. And then we're talking 8K random reads where we have cached it, right? So what's going on here is we've got this big set of JBODs. We pull a bunch of data out of it. Some of it lives in RAM now. If I go and ask for that data again, I never talk to the disk. I just pull it out of RAM. And from RAM, I get a million IOs. of normal SQL stuff, right? Because we're talking from RAM. Now RAM is the bottleneck, 1 million IOs. And then we can turn it into 32K reads, which is kind of a cheat because there's pretty much no workloads out there that do 32K. We just like to put it up there because we can and say that we can get 16.5 gigabytes of data in 1 second, so about 4 DVDs every second through that particular system. We're talking remote here, okay? And then onto that little one that I want to show you. All right, so here's the demo. Now, again, I would need shelves and shelves of disks to go and demonstrate this. So what I've done is I've hijacked somebody else's setup who has shelves and shelves of disks to go and show you. 1 million IOPS, but not just 1 million IOPS. More than that, remember I said a big normal proper SAN that's very, very expensive will get you about 200,000 if you're lucky. We're going to do 1 million, but from the point of view of a VM. Right? A VM is going to do this. So here we go. This is our VM setup in Hyper-V. We have 64 logical CPUs that he's hovering over right there. Right? 64 CPUs. He's going to connect down to multiple SCSI controllers. We can have 4. Each of those SCSI controllers has a disk attached to it. Right? And what we're going to do is fire up an I/O application. These disks are SSDs. Can't see the size of them, but they're real physical individual hard disks. This iometer will fire up 4 different worker processes. Each of those processes will run 12 threads. 12 is the number of disks that are attached to each of those SCSI controllers. We're going to do 8K random reads, pure SQL, pure exchange traffic here. So when is he ready here? We'll start firing this guy up. Come on, don't be shy. All right, here we go. Oh, we're going to show us Task Manager first. Yes. Okay, so here are the 4 different worker processes coming up here. These Dynamo, they're the 4 processes. And what he's done is he's pegged them to individual CPUs, right? Because one thread will go and live effectively on each of these CPUs, and that will effectively direct traffic to one particular disk on one particular SCSI controller to really maximize it out. You could do, I mean, the equivalent of this is just to have a really big SQL database with data spread across all these different disks, and we'll just go across and find them. So we're going to fire up Iometer and say, go do your work. We're looking at total number of IOs per second. This takes a bit to go and warm up here. 1.6 million IOs per second from a VM. From a VM, not a physical server. In fact, you take that whole scenario that I was drawing up before with the 64 nodes and the server on the other side, the set of servers, the scale-out file servers, we can get more IOs per second from the VMs than we can from the physical servers. Here we're looking at the individual CPUs. Again, 64 CPUs, too difficult to show here, so it's gone and put little numbers for each of the different cores. So you can see they're all hovering at about 82, 85%, so they're not quite maxed out, but you wouldn't want to go any higher. And then we've left 4 cores alone because we don't have the disks, and even if we did, we wouldn't want to use them because it would slow things down. This is the right number of disks to have because we would be hitting the RAM bottleneck and we'd cause queuing in there. So we've left it at 16 on each of the 4 sockets. We have 16 cores, right? 12 of them are in use, 4 of them are not. Absolutely maxed out. That's pretty cool, right? So we can get back to that point. We can get more IOs from a VM running remotely than we can from the actual hardware of the machine. So if I talk back to this picture here, we can get more IOs from these guys. In some situations, not all of them, but in some situations, these guys can perform better. That's the wrong tool, that's why, mate. There we go, right? Because when I'm doing RDMA, I don't have to go and talk through any protocols anymore, right? There's none of this delay in packaging stuff up into TCP and then packaging it up into packets that go through the storage stack anymore. It's just directly in your memory. So SMB has been that much heavily modified that we can improve performance between these guys, VMs running remotely, the storage on the other side. Well, you don't want it to be you're a square. Yeah. All the way over to here. We can go faster. Not all the time, right? But if we can go and switch off a whole lot of stuff, like effectively turning off all of your antivirus and all of your blah, 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 we can beat locally attached storage. We've got another demo coming up here. Oops, we did that one. T tiered storage. So we have tiered storage too. We didn't have this in 2012. Okay, this is a 2012 R2 feature. And the idea behind having tiered storage is that we have a bunch of hard drives and then a bunch of SSDs. And hot data, data that's been accessed in the last 20 minutes, will be living in SSD. And as soon as it's not been accessed, after 20 minutes, we have a little scheduled task that goes through and it does trim commands to the SSD to go and send it back down onto the hard drive. And if we've got some special files that we know we access a lot, we can pin that file into SSD so it stays in SSD. And an example of that would be, it's the use case for why they invented this whole thing in the first place. It is so that you can go and take a parent hard disk to a virtual machine and put the parent part inside SSD and then have all of your Delta files that make all of your VDI machines on the spinning hard disk. They will grow, they'll become big. They'll still get good IOs, but they won't get fantastically good IOs like you would for the parent disk. And what's on the parent disk? Well, it's all the boot files for Windows, so I can boot a ridiculous number of VMs, like 8,000, right? I can boot them all really quickly. And then when they go and launch Word, all of the binaries are on the SSDs. That's what they invented it for, was the ability to go and pin them. So let's go and build ourselves a nice tiered storage storage pool, it's called. So on here, we've got listed all of our physical disks. Can pool means that you can be put into a storage pool. We've got some sizes, 200 gigs. They are the SSDs. And where are we going here? We're going to go and create a new storage pool. So everything is being done purposefully in PowerShell, and I'll show you the GUI side of it in a second. We go and create the big pool. From that pool, we go and say, go and get me all of the disks that are of a certain type. And we can see the media type. It's part of the requirement. Let me just pause this one. It's part of the requirement for hard drive manufacturers to tell Windows what type of disk they are. They must say whether they're HDD or SSD. Right? They must tell us, and then we go and get them. You will occasionally find disks that don't do that, but you can still override them if you know what kind of disk it is. Off it goes. So what we're doing here is we're building two tiers, an SSD tier and then a hard drive tier. The SSD tier contains everyone whose media type is SSD, and a hard drive tier. Now we're going to go and build ourselves a virtual disk, so a storage space, a LUN that you're going to go and call to your storage guy. We're going to set up this LUN with a combination of tiers. So we're going to say, look, your storage tiers are both the first one we created, the SSD, and the hard drive tier. The two sizes of each of those tiers, so we want to give just a small amount of the SSD bit to this whole volume. 150 gigs is all we need, because it's just going to have the parent files in there. And then we're going to give 1.7 terabytes to the spinning hard disks. We're going to set that up to be in a mirror. And then we're also going to enable write caching that we'll get to in just a second. Oh, sorry, guys. Let me skip it through. Where were we? About there. There we go. Cool. So it goes and creates a virtual disk, right? A storage space that you would call a LUN. When it's doing this, it's provisioning it thin, but not like super thin. It's not like it's allocating 4 megs. It's actually going to allocate quite a lot of space in there, because it could be that the next thing you do is go and write a bunch of data, a whole lot of data. And if I haven't already allocated that space, then it could be that that first write is a bit slow and you won't be too happy about it. Because this stuff here wins or loses on the day that you do the installation, right? And if it doesn't perform well on the first one, you're not going to be so interested in it. So we do pre-allocate quite a lot of space from the start. So it's going to take a little bit of time to go and write some of that data out, right? And we're talking maybe 2-ish percent. It's not a fixed percent, but you'll see that when you go and pre-allocate, your disks actually do get used quite a bit. You can do all of this stuff on your Windows 8 machines. Right, storage spaces is not a server product. You can do this on your other machines too. Created the space, go and create a drive letter. Right, so this disk that has two different types of data on it, we've got the SSD and the HD, they appear as E drive. right? But a layer below E drive knows about the bits that are fast and the bits that are slow. And where are we going? So we're going to go and pin a file. So we're taking a file that's called marketing pool parent VM and putting it on the SSD tier. And then a file that's called archive one, we're putting on the hard drive tier. And then we go and ask our E drive, can you go tell me what files have been placed on what areas? And you can see that this one here, the E drive, the archive file is on the hard drive tier. So we can find out all that information. And then we'll go and trigger it to say, can you go and optimize these tiers? Because that data is living wherever, right? We just placed the data down somewhere. Now we have to go and tell it, can you go and optimize it so that if you should be on an SSD, then you actually are on an SSD. And the thing that it's running in the background here is defrag, really. The defrag has this optimize for tiers option, and that's what it's doing. It's going and moving the blocks of data to put them in the right places. And now we are completely on our tier, the one that we should be on. And it will do this automatically, right? There is a scheduled task that will go through and clean up all this data for you, but you can also force it to run there like we did just now. So here's write-back caching. This idea is, again, a SAN idea. If I want to write an enormous amount of data into a SAN, I want that write to happen really, really quickly. I don't want it to be blocked by somebody else reading or backing up an Exchange database or something like that. A write should happen fast. This is that cache option that we saw in the first bit, where we say, let's go and dedicate part of the SSD tier to be write cache. So all writes go in there. All writes that happen to this whole LUN hit the SSDs first. So here's a demo of us setting up a couple of different LUNs and doing some normal reads and writes, right? The blue line is just normal everyday traffic going to these two LUNs. Here's one where we've gone in and enabled write-back caching, and here where we haven't yet. And then we'll go and fire off a burst of writes, so make it do something that is heavy writing. And what you'll see over here is that this guy, he accepts those writes. There they go, they fire in there. We get an awful lot more IOs per second coming through. But it never affects our reading and our other data going on down here. Down here, without the cache, reads stop. Effectively, this blue line doesn't stop here. It goes all the way down to zero, right? Because newer information has come in. I have to deal with that one first. So the writes get priority, and I no longer read. Do it again, flat line, no problem. Deal with it just fine. Here, panic, zero, not reading, backup, stops, Exchange, not working for a while, right? You just put in a switch. All you have to do when you create this stuff is put in a switch and says, include a cache of, I don't know, 5 gigs, 10 gigs, whatever it is. I deal with the write, and then I go and send it onwards. Here we're talking to a tiered volume, so we're firing up SQLIO again, doing 8K random reads. There's the random reads happening now. And then what we'll do is we'll move that database from the hard drive tier, and we're getting 2,600 IOs per second, so maybe 12 disks, 12 hard drives. We'll go and move it from the hard drive tier to the SSD tier. Still on the E drive, right? We haven't reformatted the disk. The workload is still running. So we're going to go and pin that data to the SSD tier, and then we have to go and do that optimized job where we actually move the blocks, right? This is live data that's being touched, and we're moving it to different disks. And as more and more of that data moves onto it, because we're doing random reads, right, could come from anywhere in this huge file, we're just going through the file chunk by chunk, putting it up to SSD, the more of it that it is there, the faster overall our reads are able to happen. And now we're able to get 28,000 IOs per second, so about 10 SSDs we're working off at the same time. No change to your application. In fact, no change to your storage pools either. You can just come along and you've got a pre-configured storage pool. You just add more SSDs. Just add them in and say you are now part of an SSD tier for this pre-existing pool. Vupti, off it goes. Vupti, first Danish word. What else have we got inside storage spaces? This is just a huge array of different features. In fact, I should probably check on the time. Make sure I don't keep you guys past beer o'clock. We've got 12 minutes. That's great. Okay, so storage space. This is a LUN, remember? If one of our disks inside this LUN dies, it's not like a mirror has a replicated partner, another disk that we copy from, our parity data exists wherever. So what we effectively have is a bunch of different places we can copy the data back from should one of these disks die. So we've got an example here of a 3 terabyte hard drives that have 2.4 terabytes of data on them. So they're all almost full. They're in a 4-column mirror, which means that we've got 2 replicating with 2. And in this case, we really do have 4 disks, right? We could have 100 and we'd be spreading it all across all of those. But we have a 4-column mirror. And it's a 2-way mirror, which means that we don't have a third copy of the data, which we can also have in R2. We kill one of them, put it back, and then watch how fast it goes and puts that data back. If in 2012 you did this, what you'd have is a hot spare, and it would centralize all of the I.O. onto that one disk, and that disk would die, right? We'd be sending all of our data there. What we're told is, look, you've got to have 4 copies of this data all throughout. So go and find other disks inside this array that don't have this copy of the data anywhere and put a copy on it. It doesn't need to be the one that you just inserted. And then other disks that have data on them, we could start moving that into the new disk slowly but surely over time. It's not an important thing to have happen, but we will do it. We'll go and take that data and spread it across all of our disks evenly. So we can rebuild that array by adding one disk and getting 4 full copies of the data in 49 minutes. Right? This assumes that there's no foreground activity on it, right? So this is the best case scenario, but it's also hard drives. It's a fantastic story. The VHDX file format. So we had, the VHD format's been around for a really, really long time, and it hit a lot of problems, performance problems, and limitations. It's limited to 2 terabytes. Disks now we want to make even bigger than that. And the new types of hard disks that are coming out, these types here, we've always had 512-byte hard disks. That's what we've had since the 60s, 512 bytes. Now we can have disks that are 4096 bytes, right? So they have sector alignment at 4096, which matches perfectly to the way the Windows wants to format a disk. So that's absolutely great. We'd love to have these disks. That's why they invented them. Because you, instead of taking a 4K write and then slicing it up into 512 chunks, you just do it in once. Problem is that not all applications in OS support that, so they have this middle bit that's called 512E, which is 4096 disks that look like 512 to those who need it. And a VHD will only work on a 512. It has appalling performance on all the other types, and a VHDX is now aware of it. Differencing in dynamic disks will grow really fast now. It's kind of an important thing. We're not just talking a little bit here. It's like 10 times faster, right? So if you're going to put in a VDI or you're going to put in virtual servers, you would always say, I want to pre-configure all that disk space, format it, allocate it for me. And your SAN guy would say, but I don't want to do that because then it would actually require me to go and buy disks to go and supply all of that, and you aren't going to use it. So now you can have dynamically expanding disks because you're not effectively going to see the growth factor taking any of your time. Like I said before, a file server wants to write in 64K, so this is a hugely important number here. So now we can really have a file server with 64K formatted chunks going really fast into it. And we can dynamically resize a VHDX to be bigger and smaller without taking the file offline. Right? So while it's being used, while a VM is running it, and there's a really simple little 2-minimum size there. So if I've gone and taken a VHD, I've defragged it, and I got rid of the page file, right? And I compressed it as much as I can by running defrag and optimize unused space, I can go and run this one from the host, and it will shrink it down and occupy less disk space. A bunch of other stuff. Didn't know what to call this one, that's why. We can have, I really wanted to give you a demo of this one here, but it requires special hardware. You need to have a JBOD with SAS. You need to have a laptop with a SAS connection on the outside. I don't, I've only got USB 3, so it wasn't going to work for me. I tried everything to try and find a SAS controller that would plug into USB 3 and look like it, and it was just not going to work. So what we need here, what we're talking about here is the ability to take a VHD file, stick it on a hard drive, and then share it between multiple VMs. I'll show you a little option we can use to do that with. Let me jump back here. I got my Hyper-V admin? No. Hyper-V. Here he is here. So if I go and connect to one of these VMs, let's choose one of this all here. Go to his disk. That's an advanced feature that says enable virtual hard disk sharing. Right? What it's really doing is saying this individual VHD, not all the others, just this one, now supports SCSI persistent reservations, which is needed by clustering. A persistent reservation says, through the SCSI controller, I own this LUN. And clustering will just keep hammering at that LUN saying, I want to take it. And another node will say, I want to take it, I want to take it. And if I'm still online, I claim to be the owner all the time because I scrub out everybody else as an owner. Right? We need that persistent reservation thing to be there. Before, we had to use iSCSI disks, so you would have a third file server inside your VM environment that would go and provide a hard disk that way, right, through iSCSI, because iSCSI would support persistent reservations. And same with Fibre Channel. We could have a virtual machine running virtual Fibre Channel adapters. So if my physical host had Fibre Channel, I can give real Fibre Channel up to my VMs. And then I can go and carve out a LUN and use the worldwide name so that only the VMs can see it and they can cluster. Not so good on a laptop. And this one makes things a little bit easier. If we've got SAS-capable hardware that the VHD is actually living on, we can go and tick that box. What else? You shouldn't see those. You're cheating. The other one there was the storage quality of service. So for a particular hard drive, we can say, these are the minimum number of IOPS that you should have. If you ever drop below that, as in you're starved for IOPS because some other VM is trying to use too much of your disk, what we do is we send an alert. It's not a hard limit for the minimum. It's not like we just beef it up and say, nope, I'm taking my IOs, you all can go away. We have soft limits for the minimums, but we have hard limits for the maximum. So if you have some misbehaving VM, who just keeps consuming IOs, you can dynamically go in and say, no, the maximum number of IOs you get is this, and it drops down as you hit the enter button on the VHD file. In fact, it was the same exact place that we were looking at just here. This one here, enable QoS. So the minimum, soft, maximum, firm, this is the absolute top number of IOs per second you're allowed, per hard drive. It's pretty cool. CSV rebalancing. Okay, so I've got a storage space, a storage pool that has a storage space. That space I will configure as a clustered shared volume, meaning that all three, four nodes can access that exact same disk at the same time. They can all make writes to the same disk at the same time. Only one of them owns it, so only metadata changes happen in one place, but all of them can make writes. The best thing that I can do is have all of my incoming connections talk to the CSV owner, the guy that owns that node, so that those metadata updates don't go cross-node, and if perhaps my access to the storage dies, I would be redirected through the owning node. Really, accessing through the owner node is the best way to go. The best configuration you can have in 2012 R2 is the same number of CSVs as you do have file server nodes. So if I have four nodes, have four CSVs, or eight. Or 12, right? Nice even multiples of the number of nodes that you have so that we can go and spread the CSVs across all of the different nodes. And then clustering will be so clever as to say, oh, I have 12 different CSVs and I have four file servers hosting them, so I will rebalance the ownership of CSVs across all of the nodes so that we get an even spread of IOs across all possible nodes. We talked about this one before. We can flood an RDMA adapter so that it will flood the RAM. Right? We can make an RDMA adapter go up to 450 IOs per second. There's an enormous number of features that I've even forgotten about that I haven't even mentioned. For the SMB side, that connecting into the scale-out file server, if the node that I'm talking to dies, it doesn't matter. The changeover is so fast because that node has already told another node, look, this server, file 44, he's trying to access these files. He's got locks on these files. Can you remember the lock setup for me just in case I die? And through SMB, I tell that guy, your backup, if I die, if you can't get packets to me, just start talking to file server number 12 because he knows all about your lock information. Right? I've already told him all of this. So when I go down, it just fails over instantly. Like 0.2 seconds, the failover happens. The VMs never notice. None of your workloads will stall if the node that I'm talking to happens to die through this scale-out file server. What else was there? There was another one that I thought of. I've forgotten it now. Oh, well. Let's take it to the next level to finish this off. We have bought a company that's called StoreSimple. It does one thing, and it does it really well. It enables you to turn Windows Azure Blob storage into a tier of storage for your network. So like we had a hard drive tier and an SSD tier, you can put in this caching box on your network that will make it appear as cloud storage. So it makes it look like your Azure Blob storage is local, and it has this box as a buffer in between them. All writes up into Azure cost you nothing. It's the reads that are the things that start costing you money. Not a lot of money. We're talking gigabytes for cents. You know, it's a really small amount. But this is, I think, a really important change to the way that we're going to start working. We're going to see more of this, where we're going to offload more stuff up into Azure. I said Azure Blob Storage. I probably shouldn't have dropped that in there, but I've opened a can of worms. Azure Blob Storage is scale-out file server. Really, that's what it is, but hosted in Azure. If I've got a million Hyper-V servers all accessing something, that something happens to be this whole thing that we talked about, scale-out file server with the SMB multi-channel, the transparent failover, all of that is Azure Blob Storage. That's where your virtual hard disks live, inside Azure. The stuff that you can install here, they already have done, and probably have done it cheaper than you ever could as well. I say that all of this stuff is really cheap. It's really cheap compared to a SAN, but a SAN's really expensive. That's like saying it's a really cheap car compared to a Ferrari, right? Azure is just it's a massive bus. It's huge. It's massive and almost free to go and set up, and it gives you coverage all over the world. I was terribly afraid of Azure when I saw it, right? I thought, there's no way that any well-minded human being would go and move their storage stuff or their servers or their normal infrastructure into this cloud stuff. It makes no sense at all. But the more you look into it, you see, oh, right, I could have 7 different data centers across the world with massive high availability on them, and it cost me nothing, effectively. You know, the cost per VM is tiny in Azure compared to what you can do it for. If you start adding up what it really costs you to run your stuff internally, it's nothing compared to what you can get in Azure. You're paying a huge premium to running it on-premise. It's well worth looking into. I was working with a customer, I'm from New Zealand, and I went back there just a little while ago. I was working with an outsourcing customer down there that was hosting Hyper-V for customers, and they were getting an awful lot of just crappy VMs, you know? The people wanted to outsource their junk because they didn't want to look after it anymore. The customers wanted to hold on to their good data and then just send them all of their junk. And they ended up with a bunch of junk VMs. While I was there, in like 2 days, we set them up with an Azure account and started moving, live migrating their VMs from on-premise inside this hosted cloud up into Azure, and the customers never knew. Setting up all the networking and everything took 2 days, and they were working, and it was cheaper for them to host running VMs up in the cloud than it was on their own hardware. It's really, really interesting stuff when you start digging into it. Okay, I think I've hit my time limit. So you've probably seen this slide a couple of times already. It is really important that we do get your evaluations in. And I'll tell you why. Because if you've been walking around here, and by Thursday you would have seen a lot of them, you see a lot of guys with very nice haircuts and very shiny shoes. Those guys are going to the sessions that you don't like so much, the kind of more dry 200 level, not so much fun sessions, right? They fill in their surveys. And if we're not filling in our surveys too, it's gonna start looking the way that those shiny guys like it to look, right? We don't really want that anymore. So we want you guys to start sending in your feedback. It is acted on, right? The fact that I was here last year and that I'm able to be here again depends on the fact that you do your surveys, and my team as well, they come along too. So this is what your message will eventually look like, okay? You don't have to put those numbers in there, but you know, I love you. And for those who are up for it tonight, there's a New Zealand band in town, the biggest band of New Zealand. It's called Fat Freddy's Drop. They're playing tonight at Vega. It's apparently sold out, but there's always guys hanging around outside with dreadlocks and some things in one pocket and some things in the other pocket. So I do encourage you to go along. It's going to be lots of fun. Yeah, and thank you very much for coming. Thank you for sitting through it. Thank you for being a wonderful team. Come up and ask any questions. I'll be here for 20 minutes, half an hour. Thank you.